Well, 41 years ago, he wrote the score for the first of these and received an Academy Award nomination. And eventually, the Academy Award. And this year, he received his 51st Oscar nomination for the most recent one. And here to begin the 9 o'clock hour of tonight's program is the main title music and Escape, music from Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams, conducted by the composer. The main titles and Escape from Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams. Now, I should tell you, I'm watching the movie, and this score, this immense, incredibly rich, incredibly complicated score, is just washing over me. And I'm thinking this whole thing came from a guy using a pencil on paper, you know, yes. The way... Yes. You know, Bach used to do it that way, Beethoven, you know, worked for them.
I see. Like, it certainly worked for them. I am completely unreconstructed in this, Jim. I'm still using a pencil and paper and writing out all the parts and all of this. And look, I mean, 20 years or so ago, or 30 even now, I suppose I could have retooled and learned how to use a computer as I should have, I'm sure, because I know it's much quicker. But my excuse, Jim, is that I was always so busy in those years that I didn't have time to go back to relearn how to do this, and kept sharpening black wing pencils all day long.
Sure.
You know? Sure. And so I haven't stopped. It certainly is labor intensive, and it must be slower. I have younger colleagues who cover films in a matter of a month or two, where it takes me 5 or 6 months to write it all. But pencil is still a useful tool, and paper, we still need it.
You know, yeah, and I've got nothing against technology in and of itself, but I mean, whatever worked. There's this wonderful poem by Carl Shapiro, great American poet, and it's about all these glasses that he has in a drawer. And he goes over what kind of glasses he's got, even special glasses for proofreading poems. And the last line for all of us technophobes is, so what if I had to make up poems in my head like Milton or Homer? Mm-hmm. So whatever works, I think,
yes.
Is the moral of this
story.
Well, the man who just received his 51st Academy Award nomination has stopped in tonight. We're going to be playing the score for Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams, and talk about whatever John Williams wants to talk about, as per usual. John, welcome back to KUSC.
Thank you, Jim. Very happy to see you again, as always.
The main titles and that opening cue, it's a 7.5-minute cue, which by film standards is a pretty long chunk of time.
Well, in the case of Star Wars, of course, it's a short introduction for the other 2 or 3 hours of music is to follow. We actually, I mean, at this point of the length of the score, we recorded 184 minutes of music. That's over 3 hours of music for this film. And the film ended up to be 242, whatever the length it is. And the reason for that is that the changes we make as we go along, we record many scenes always in the film world. We record them in a longer state than they're ever going to be. People do that, I suppose, as a result of a kind of defensive thing. We'll build it up as big as we can and shape it down.
Sure.
And so composers have to deal with this always. But Star Wars has been, certainly in my experience, unique in that as we plan to place the music in the film, a process that we usually call spotting, that is to spot where the music is going to be placed or not placed. The process of spotting with Star Wars is a very simple one. We just decide that when the film starts, the orchestra will play, and when the film ends, the orchestra will stop. So it makes the scene selection very simple.
Yeah.
You play all of them.
So in other words, at this point, you've got more music than Wagner wrote for the Ring Cycle. In your Star Wars films?
Probably so.
Yes.
Probably through. And yet more to come. J.J. Abrams, you know, there's a line in this recent, the rebellion is reborn, is said by someone in the film, I think it's Luke, giving us a hint that there's yet more to come. So we know J.J. Abrams is preparing one now that I will hopefully do next year for him. And look forward to it. It will round out a series of nine. And that will be quite enough for me. Disney Studios probably will take it further. You know, as your listeners will know, that Disney has acquired the rights for Lucasfilm, and they will probably continue on through decades, possibly, of doing Star Wars-related attractions.
Yeah.
So I think it's all good. I always have to think that when we talk about Star Wars, that doing the first film in 1977, none of us had any idea that there would be a second film. And I don't think George Lucas had that idea in his mind either. So it's developed in the most amazing way. The families, Ray's parents, might be identified to us in the next film.
Yeah. Well, I hope so.
I hope so, too.
I assume they're pretty extraordinary. Not just what somebody tried to tell her, that they were just, you know, anonymous people who died in the desert.
Yes.
Yes. I don't really believe that.
I don't believe it either. I adore it. You know, Ray, of course, is played by Daisy Ridley, who I'm so loved in The Force Awakens. And last year when Kathy Kennedy rang me up and said, would you do the last music for The Last Jedi? I said to her, is Daisy in it? And she said, yes. So I said, yes.
Well, I'm sure she'll be in the next one, too.
I hope so.
Here's some more music from Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams. Including with the cue call, The Supremacy, music from Star Wars, The Last Jedi, music by John Williams. Who is my guest tonight here on 91.5 Classical KUSC. Well, I suppose to ask the obvious question, writing Leia's theme must have been tough and poignant and must have been a very tough assignment on this picture.
I think it was for all of us. Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia, of course. I think possibly might be argued that she did her best work in this last film. I remember so well the scene between Luke and Leia where they meet, and really very deeply touching, I thought. I didn't know Carrie very well, but I always enjoyed her humor and her wit, and it's a great loss. She made quite an impression worldwide in her role as Princess Leia.
Yeah, so. And became, and it's a tough, tough thing to do, but one of the great script doctors in Hollywood history. I mean, when they were having trouble with a script,
yeah,
they would call her and she would fix it.
Yes, 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 yes. That's right. She was a very witty girl and been brilliant in her writing and her quick, entertaining manner that she could have. I was very concerned, Jim, about how, given the unfortunate time of her passing, how it would affect the film's viewers. And I'm happy to say that I think people are warmed and pleased to see her and enjoy her presence in the film. I think it's been a good thing, a good reaction to the loss of someone who fans have been so devoted to and have, in a way, worshipped for so many decades.
Yeah, exactly.
They loved seeing her, and they loved seeing these scenes that she was able to do. Her voice was a little bit hoarse, you know, in some of the scenes you may have noticed. But she carried on, and she did a more than convincing job, I think. Two or three very touching scenes in the film.
Yeah. And apparently actually did some of the writing, you know, in the last scene.
I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. She has a very touching scene with Laura Dern somewhere in the middle of the film,
yeah.
I think. It's very, very, very sweet. So I think it's been unfortunate and sad to lose her, but we're lucky to have this bit of Carrie in this film.
We are indeed. Let's hear some more music from Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams. concluding with the cue called Rebellion is Reborn, music from Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams, who is my guest tonight here on 91.5 Classical KUSC. And, of course, this puts you only 8 nominations behind Walt Disney. So, and as I always like to point out, you know, the overwhelming majority of Disney nominations, number one, were for short subjects, for The Three Little Pigs, for instance, and, you know, Ferdinand the Bull. Mm-hmm. And they all ran about 7 or 8 minutes.
Right.
And, of course, he had a whole studio working behind him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you did this, and I think it's widely regarded as a far more competitive category. And except for, you know, occasional touches of orchestration, you did it all by yourself. So it's like...
Yes, like a monk in a room somewhere. Well, 51 nominations. It's hard to get my mind around that, Jim. I think, firstly, no one could be that old to have been around that long and working. And it says something about time, the way it evaporates in the curve, the way it will go across our lives. And now I've got grandchildren who are marrying suddenly, and I'm feeling about the same as I did 40 years ago, and hard to believe all of this. But I must say that the nominations, all 51 of them, are a gift to me from the music branch of the Academy, who, and as your listeners, many of them will know, the music branch is the segment of the Academy that makes the nominations for the composing awards. And so these are nominations for my colleagues, and they all mean so much to me from that point of view. The simple fact that they haven't tired of me after all these years pleases me very much. And the other thing I have to say, Jim, is that each one of them feels new. It doesn't feel like something an old hat experienced, so to speak. I think it's a human thing that we all want to be recognized, and it's recognizably human to be pleased about it. So I don't feel blasé. What I can't get my mind around is the number.
Well, yeah, Walt had the same problem. You know, if you go to the Disney studios, there's this big thing with all the Oscars, or at least a big chunk of the Oscars.
Yes.
And he won 22 competitive ones.
Did
but
he?
Again, it was his studio, yes. And again, it was for 8-minute pieces. Well, not to denigrate Walt Disney.
Not at all, my goodness. It does remind me of the fact that the music branch rules have changed many times. And in the 1930s, Leo Forbstein, who was the music director of Warner Brothers Studios, accepted the Oscar, which was given to Eric Korngold. The Oscar award went not to the composer, but to the music director of the studio. So many changes have come along. There used to be a category for musical director, I think, that created this confusion. I think the category of adaptation is still being used. I'm not sure about that. Adaptation meaning one of my Oscars was for the adaptation of the score for Fiddler on the Roof and conducting it and reorchestrating all of that.
Yeah.
Not sure that award still exists. Maybe a category that we've jettisoned.
Yeah. And, of course, in the old days, the days of, you know, the Al Newmans and the Leo Forbsteins, you know, the only guy you had to please really was whoever was head of the music department.
That's right.
Because the director, he finished with the film and he finished with it.
We never saw him.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
And Alfred, of course, has a lot of Oscars for music direction for musicals and so on that he conducted. And some original scores, I think, also. The Newman family, it's amazing. You know, they're all so gifted. And David and Tommy and Randy, of course, they are a special part of this community and music world.
Yeah, they're Hollywood's box.
That's right.
As a matter of fact.
That's right.
Well, let's hear some more music from the 51st Academy Award nomination that its composer just received, music from Star Wars The Last Jedi. Including with the cue called Chrome Dome, more music from Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams. Now, of course, while you were doing Star Wars The Last Jedi, you were doing a little project for Steven Spielberg as well. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a fairly busy year.
Yes, it was.
And I can't think of two more utterly different scores.
True. Going into the post after Star Wars was like a dessert, completely different and not a long score. The film itself, I don't think, is very long. But it was certainly a change of pace, and it was lovely to be back with Steven always. And I enjoyed it very much.
Yes, this Star Wars, there are several new characters that popped up.
Mm-hmm.
So they all have to have new themes. And the way the symphonic manipulation of all those themes, I think you can make a serious case that in this score, it kind of reaches its absolute height in the sense that it is all so subtle, but it also does exactly what it needs to do. I mean, it tells you what's going on. It tells you what people are really feeling. But the way the themes are manipulated in this score is just astounding. I was talking to a colleague of yours who went on at some length about how, number one, this is the best Star Wars score to date, and number two, it's music by a young composer, just full of energy and ideas and life.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that. That's wonderful. Star Wars, of course, presents a unique opportunity. I think you probably agree, Jim, in the sense that the leitmotivic approach that seems to be welcome in Star Wars, the process of identifying characters with themes and so on, is a process that wouldn't apply to contemporary style in general terms of modern filmmaking. I don't think it's something you would want to do in majority of films that are using today wonderful computerized and electronic sounds in their scores, you know, which are atmospheric and generally non-melodic, I think on purpose, I would imagine, from point of view of aesthetic choices that people make. But in Star Wars, the swords come out and the action takes place and no one really gets hurt. And there are good guys and good girls and bad girls, and they can all have their identifying motifs. And we actually get away with it. And it's really fun to sling these melodic things around in various modalities and orchestral settings and so on, and sew little tapestries with them, a 2-bar reference to something here and a 3-bar reference there. Probably the listener doesn't absorb all of it in the first hearing. But I think we have to believe that there's some unconscious process as we go through the audiovisual experience of it, that the themes wedded to the characters connects the audience in some way that they perhaps wouldn't if this technique were not used.
Oh, it absolutely does.
I have to say, Jim, the beginning, could go back to 1977 again, I didn't really set out on purpose to create a glossary of themes that we have now. To say again, I had no idea that there would be a second film. And there would be a Darth Vader, and there would be this one and that one coming along the way and requiring themes, and that I would be challenged to try to organize a stylistic unity, if I could, from film to film over decades. And that in itself is probably a unique opportunity, to be able to be working on a subject and a theme and a group of themes over 40 years. That's probably a unique experience, certainly in film.
Oh, absolutely.
And possibly in theater.
Yeah. And I'll bet you didn't actually consciously set out in 1977 to do what Star Wars did. It brought the symphony orchestra back to films. Up to then, people were getting away with zithers and guitars and so forth, and jazzy elements. I mean, wonderful scores. Mm-hmm. But this really reintroduced the symphony orchestra to Hollywood.
People have asked me, the London Symphony associated with Star Wars very prominently, they will ask me, well, is that the first score that London Symphony ever recorded? I thought, well, through the years, you may remember the name Muir Mathieson, who conducted so many scores with the London Symphony Orchestra. I think the scores of Walton and Vaughan Williams' Antarctica, might have been the London Symphony with Mathieson. We can look that one up. But I think that in the intervening years, probably somewhere in the 50s and 60s, the practice of using orchestras had dwindled. We certainly had them with Korngold and others here. So I can't claim to have established anything that hadn't been done for many, many years by fabulous people.
Yeah, but it reminded people of a great chunk of Hollywood's golden age.
True. I think it connected a nostalgia perhaps with people. But music is such a irreplaceable partner in film. We just can't conceive of film without a musical heart of it, soul of it perhaps. We recognize that there are films that have no music that are great films, but generally speaking, I don't think you can. Bernard Herrmann, I can't quote him, perhaps you could, but he always insisted that music was a big, big part of film. You can't have film without music, he insisted.
No, he's absolutely right. And why would you want to be without it? I mean, there are some directors who I assume think they can get away without music, but it is such an immensely important thing, as you said. And in that recent HBO biography that they did on Steven Spielberg, you know, he was talking about all his many collaborators. I don't know if you've seen the thing. But he says, you know, my longest collaboration is with John, and it's the most important because he always elevates every picture to a level that I never guessed it could go to.
He's very kind to me in saying that. But what I can say about Steven is that he loves music. And he will come to the recording stage and sit there and imbibe it in a physical way. He's a fan of orchestras. And if the session goes a little longer, he doesn't complain about overtime. He doesn't want it to stop.
Yes.
So it's a very fortunate thing for me to collaborate with a man that way. He grew up in Philadelphia partly, and his mother took him to orchestra concerts in Philadelphia. And the concertmaster of the orchestra at that time was Jacob Krochmalnik. And so when we recorded Jaws, Stephen brought his mother to the stage, and in our orchestra prominently was sitting Jacob Krochmalnik, and his mother, Lee, said, Stephen has finally arrived.
Yes. You know, he's
in one of my son's movies, we have Krochmalnik from Philadelphia playing the violin for Stephen's score. And he remains a great enthusiast about music.
Yeah.
I'm also, if it's appropriate to say this in this kind of a setting, but Stephen has just endowed a scholarship at the Juilliard School in the name of his mother, who was an amateur pianist who played chamber music and so on. And so we're all very happy and very proud of Stephen and his support for music education in this case and in other cases. So he's been a collaborator to dream of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, here is some more music from Star Wars The Last Jedi, beginning with that great battle scene, which I actually couldn't believe. And I had to go back and see the movie a couple of more times to make sure my mind wasn't playing tricks on me. Here's more music from Star Wars The Last Jedi, music by John Williams. Including with The Last Jedi, the name of the cue, music from The Last Jedi and the new Star Wars picture, for which the composer just received his 51st Academy Award nomination. John Williams is my guest tonight here on 91.5 Classical KUSC, the member-supported broadcast service of the University of Southern California. And listening to that incredible battle scene and the playing of that orchestra, I'm reminded something John Carigliano told me. He said the first time he came out here to do a picture, the picture was Altered States, which had, you know, a really scary, complex, difficult score. And he said he went to the first recording session, and here leading the cello section is Eleanor Slatkin, you know, the founding cellist of the Hollywood String Quartet, greatest string quartet to have ever made recordings, and comparable people sitting in the orchestra. And they went through this cue that he wrote that he thought he'd spend the day there, you know, explaining how it was done. They sight-read it, and they nailed it. And John, who grew up literally in the New York Philharmonic, his dad was the concertmaster for years. He said, this is the greatest orchestra I've ever heard. And I think that's still the case. The greatest orchestras on earth are right here in Los Angeles, yeah. The people who play in the studios.
Yes, they are. It's amazing. That orchestra that we hear on this recording is as good as any, I think. They come to us from Eastman and from Curtis and from Juilliard, USC, a lot of people from there. My impression of them is, Jim, that they get younger every year as I look at them, but also more technically brilliant and artistically comprehending, like a great orchestra would. Name one: Cleveland, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, all this kind of virtuoso level. I've often felt that it would be fun to do some concerts with that orchestra to get them out of the studio environment and let us play something more than a 5-minute cue or a 3-minute cue or a 7-minute cue, whatever. Toward that end, we did a recording with Stevens at Royce Hall, a collection of themes from our films done together. And it wasn't a public concert, but it was a moment where we could play through the pieces without any distraction from the film, without any constrictions of timing or any click tracks or any synchronization aids or constrictions. And it was like the joy of conducting a very great symphony orchestra. I don't know the people personally. I don't know how they gain entry into the orchestra. There's an audition system. I really don't know, even all the years I've been through this. But they come to this work at such a high level with such great training and discipline that it's a joy. I cannot ever wait to be with them for the next one.
Yeah. And as our mutual friend David Newman says, nowhere else on earth, when the chips are down and you absolutely have to get it the next day, mm-hmm. nowhere else on earth do you run into musicians like this.
I think he's right about that. And it's a different mentality, of course. You know, it's highly competitive. They don't have a comfortable tenure that orchestra members have and deserve in the major orchestras and others. So there's a pressure on them to perform constantly and at their peak. That's one part of it, I think. You and I have talked about this in other conversations. I think this began in the 30s when the need for music was becoming really acute in film, if I put it that way. We had people coming from Europe, many of whom were escaping the war and who had played in great orchestras for great conductors and so on. And this is the third or fourth generation out doing the same kind of work. I wish I could tell you how they've achieved this level of ensemble playing, because they're playing for different conductors every day with different kind of repertoire and different demands being made on them. I find that it takes about an hour to tune it, not in intonation-wise, but as an ensemble. I try to pick a couple. I don't even make takes the first hour. I just take a few cues and we play. And they get used to who their stand partner is, who they may not have sat with for 3 or 4 weeks or whatever. And it's amazing how quickly they unify into this expressive, brilliantly accomplished technical and artistic group so quickly. It's a tribute certainly to what has happened in music education over the decades. I should also say, Jim, you know, that we can all be so proud of orchestras across the country. You and I were just talking about before this broadcast. I was in Indianapolis a couple of days ago, where I did two concerts with the orchestra for their pension fund. And the playing was out of this world. And I go around to so many cities recently: Nashville, fabulous orchestra; Seattle, brilliant; San Diego; Los Angeles Philharmonic, of course. And I wonder to myself, in the European world, do they have as many orchestras as we have, and are they at the same level that we have? I can't speak to that. I haven't conducted ever in Europe. But our arts institutions in this country are so numerous, so outstanding, that I wish politicians would brag on them a little more often than they do, because the cultural vitality of the country and the sanguinary flow, so to speak, that the arts animate, the way that it animates our life, is something that we're doing a pretty good job at.
I would think so, yes.
And the Hollywood Orchestra is a prime example of how brilliant they are.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And how unrecognized in many cases they are.
Yeah, alas. Yeah. Well, you know, it's something I've been saying for many years now.
Yeah.
They're just nobody better. Yeah. Nobody better. I have to tell you, and this was not said in confidence, but one of your colleagues who also received an Oscar nomination this year. I mean, it's a wonderful score. And I told him as much. I said, it's just terrific. And he said to me, well, thank you, but have you heard John's score for Star Wars?
Well, I think I know who said it, and he's done a brilliant job, and he's a fabulous man. And that's a very, very high compliment, which I'll have an opportunity to thank him.
Well, John Williams, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Number 51, only 8 more to go. Okay. You tie him 9 more to get the all-time record.
Okay.
Nice. Here is more music from Star Wars, The Last Jedi, beginning with the cue called Peace and Purpose. Including with Peace and Purpose and Finale. Music from Star Wars, The Last Jedi. Music by John Williams, from the score that brought the composer his 51st Academy Award nomination. Music of John Williams, conducted by the composer.